So it's a bit of a multimedia event going on at the club. Before we get going with our discussion today, just a couple of quick housekeeping notes. Please do turn your phones to silent, and then remember to turn them back on when you leave the club. And also, just to tell you about an upcoming event, our next luncheon is going to take place a bit later this month. It's a window into modern China through the forbidden game of golf. Speaker is Dan Washburn, who has written about golf in China extensively. And now on to our event of the day. It's my pleasure to introduce Catherine Curnow, who has spent many years traveling to Vietnam to photograph a country that she feels very, very deeply about. Her talk today is about 25 years from darkness into light. And I asked her, why Vietnam? What is it about Vietnam that has moved her so much? She was born in Hong Kong and left here at age 11. It is a place that means a lot to her, that really, I think, got into her soul. And I think she said she sort of found herself again when she went to Vietnam for the first time in the 1990s. Catherine is a very well-known photographer. She works extensively with National Geographic, photographing spots all around the world, but perhaps it's fair to say Vietnam is her favorite. Anyway, it's my pleasure to introduce Catherine.
Thank you so much. It's such an honor to be here. It's actually really amazing to be here at the Foreign Correspondents Club in Hong Kong, where my father used to come to the old location in the 60s. So I'm going to jump right into the show because I fear that I'm trying to squeeze 25 years of photographs into a half an hour. So forgive me if I speak a little quickly. So when I first went to Vietnam in July of 1990, I saw a country that was just coming out of the darkest years of poverty and austerity, and a country full of people who had struggled and were still struggling. And I always sort of think that the figure of the man rowing kind of represented Vietnam in those years. So Ha Long Bay, early tourist boats. Tourists were just beginning to come to Vietnam. There were barely any foreigners in Vietnam at the time. These are seahorses being used for, they'll be ground up for aphrodisiacs in Ha Long Bay. And the first cruise ship started to come, 1994. This may have been one of the very first ones. And today, this photograph was taken actually on the very day that Ha Long Bay was declared a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And they're having a lot of trouble controlling the tourism and the sheer number of boats. They're not managing it very well, actually. 1990, I came across this music professor in his tiny little one-room house. And Vietnam is still so beautiful today. The landscape is lovely. This, again, was taken in 1990. In Hanoi, there were only two of the old French trams still running up and down this one line in remote Hanoi. Truc Bac Lake, a children's community pool right on Truc Bac Lake where John McCain was shot down in 1967 and then taken prisoner to the so-called Hanoi Hilton. And again, 1990, this had been the fancy French country club called the Cercle Sportif, but it had fallen into disrepair. And this is a swimming lesson. This little boy is learning how to breathe from his cigarette smoking swimming instructor. Street scene such as this. And I came across some interesting characters. The man on the left named Diep Minh Chau, married to this woman. He was devoted to Ho Chi Minh. He was an artist. And so to show his devotion to Ho Chi Minh, he painted a painting with the blood of his finger and had it sent to Ho Chi Minh, who, recognizing his devotion, sent for Diep Minh Chau to come. And they lived together in the forest for many years, and most of the busts in and statues of Ho Chi Minh in Vietnam are made by him. He's no longer alive. The famous writer Bao Ning, who was the first to write about the brutality and the horror of war, countering the government's propaganda, he wrote The Sorrow of War. And after that book, he became very reclusive. He's still alive, living outside of Hanoi today. And Pham Xuan An, who was the only non-Vietnamese journalist on staff for Time magazine during the war, while at the same time working for the communists. None of his colleagues, including my father, had any idea he was a double agent. It's said that he used to communicate messages to the communists in egg rolls. I had the opportunity to take the train, the Reunification Express, so-called, because it reunited North and South Vietnam in 1990. And these are scenes from the train. You can see it was not in very good shape. This was the first class compartment. I'm not quite sure why there was a first class in a communist country in 1990. And the food cart. This is a family waving goodbye to their relatives who are going south, perhaps to escape. And I think it shows the isolation of Vietnam at the time, that they were worried they would maybe never see their family, their relatives again, have no way to contact them. Of course, this is before email. And it just sort of represents the isolation of the country in 1990. And this is also a photograph I took at the time, which then became published a lot. And in fact, it was on the Lonely Planet Guide to Vietnam for many years. And I always wondered what happened to this woman on the train. I wanted to share the success of this photograph with her. It was on the cover, it was published all the time, and I never knew how to get in touch with her. And then one day, about 3 years ago, an article was done on me and showed the photograph of her on the train with my byline. And that day, I received a message from her daughter, Rosalyn, on Facebook. She said, "That woman in the photograph is my mother." And so about 2 years ago, we reunited for the first time in 23 years. In the mid-1990s, Vietnam opened to business. The Doi Moi policies that were actually put into place in the late 80s were starting to take effect in the mid-90s. And businessmen were coming from everywhere to start new ventures. There was an air of excitement and hope. Vietnam Airlines opened up new routes, hired French pilots, started a stewardess school. And this early entrepreneur, Viet Q, overseas Vietnamese, he had escaped, grown up in Australia, came back, he collected these Citroën cars, and he brought all kinds of business to Vietnam, John Deere, Hewlett-Packard. But about 4 years later, he was thrown into jail, because actually what happened was Vietnam wasn't ready. The government wasn't ready for this new business, and they were very suspicious of new wealth, new power, and they still are to some extent. Here's the opening for John Deere. Video games came to Vietnam in the mid-90s, a video parlor. And clubs started opening, country clubs, golf courses. But at that time, I began to see a sort of innocence go away, and you started to see these kinds of looks as the haves got richer and the have-nots got poorer. This is a street vendor. You can see she's selling Bao Ning's book, The Sorrow of War. The first fashion show at the Hanoi Opera House, this was the lighting. You can see he just turned off and on the light. This was that fashion show. And 1995, Phung An Nguyen, who was a Viet Q, she had tried to escape three times with her family, each time being sent back to Vietnam. And finally in 1992, she came back and she opened up the very trendy, popular Q Bar. A year later, she was on the cover of the New York Times Magazine. When this photograph was published in a book called Passage to Vietnam, the government was shocked. They were very angry. They said, "Our girls don't dress like that." And I learned not long ago that you can tell, a Vietnamese person can tell that she's not a real Vietnamese, quote unquote, because a real Vietnamese would grab a chicken by its feet, not by its neck. And this is Phuong An today. She's opened up the Q Bar in Hoi An. This photograph shows the ardent nationalism that the Vietnamese have for their motherland. This is in 2000, celebrating anniversary in 2000. And the Hanoi Opera House was refurbished in the late 1990s. To me, this photograph has always sort of showed the history of Vietnam in one photograph. You have the legacy of the French, this jeweled, beautiful gingerbread architecture. You have the fellow with the crutches perhaps representing the war years. You have the lonely man in the Siklo waiting for a customer. He can be identified as being from the north because of the green pith helmet. And then you have the suggestion of the future with the woman on the motorcycle. And now, of course, the streets are just clogged with motorcycles and cars. Dalat, I always think of Dalat, which is where the French used to go to escape the heat in the mountains near Saigon. I always think of it as kind of a quirky place. This is a bar, cafe. You can sit outside, or you can go inside the airplane to the karaoke bar. And a hotel in Dalat, where you can stay in the giraffe room. I've spent a lot of time with, I did when he was alive, with General Zapp, and now with his family. And I think that's determined a lot of my access and my renown in Vietnam. This was taken in 1990. I wanted to depict him as the snow-covered volcano. It's what the French called him, for his snowy white hair and his explosive temperament. And if you look at this picture and you divide his face into two halves, the left and the right, on the one side, on our right, you see the man who was compassionate and who was caring and who cared about his troops, especially the needs of his female troops. And on the left side of his face, you see the military general who said, "We will win this war at Dien Bien Phu at any cost." He invited me to go privately with him on his return to Dien Bien Phu in 1994, 40 years after the Battle of Dien Bien Phu. And we went 1 month before May 4th. We went in April, actually, and there was no other press there at the time. Here he is landing at Dien Bien Phu by the helicopter and greeting villagers in Mung Phang, the forest encampment where he hid, and while he's planned the strategy of Dien Bien Phu from March to May of 1954. The gleeful-looking woman you see sort of straight through there is his wife, Madame Dang Bi Ha, and behind her, his first daughter, who died of cancer a few years later. Here he is in the very same hut where he plotted the strategy of Dien Bien Phu. And later I asked, what was he saying then, there, at that time? And the translation was, "My only regret is that those comrades of mine who were with me then at the time are now no longer here today to be with me here today." These veterans of Dien Bien Phu are listening to General Zapp give his riveting speech. He was a very powerful speaker. And then in October of 2013, he died, and I rushed to Vietnam to photograph the funeral. And this is along the way, the funeral procession went through Quang Binh province, where he was from, and I was amazed to see these people, hundreds of them, holding up my photograph, which the photograph had been stolen off the internet. And it was one of the few times I didn't mind not getting royalties for my pictures being taken. I felt quite honored, actually. And bringing his coffin up to the burial site in Quang Binh province. The site was chosen not, even though it wasn't in his provincial birthplace, the site was chosen not for that reason. I was told this by his son at the time, who's coming up the stairs there, that the site was chosen because it was deemed auspicious. The family is very superstitious, actually, more so than your average Asian. This is the family as the coffin is being lowered into the ground. His son is there on the right, and his grandchildren and great-grandchildren, the great-grandchildren represented by their yellow headbands. The legacy of the Vietnam War, or as they call it, the U.S. War, many legacies. One was the legacy of the Amerasians, the offspring of the American soldiers or civilians and Vietnamese women. And I found myself in 1990, I found myself on a flight, sorry about that, on a flight full of Amerasians. I came across this grandmother with her granddaughter leaving for the States, and the grandmother was very hopeful that they would find the father. There's always this search for the father with Amerasians, and she was quite hopeful because they knew his name. His name was Bob. Phung Thuy, an Amerasian that I photographed for Smithsonian Magazine, this photograph ended up being a full page. And after it was published, she had been trying to get permission from the U.S. to leave Vietnam, to go to the States, to find her father. And after that photograph was published, she took the magazine to the consulate and said, "Look, does this not prove that I am half American? I'm not half Canadian or half French, I'm half American." And they gave her and her family permission to leave. She came to the States and she found her father, maybe. They both decided not to be DNA tested, as if they wanted to just preserve the dream. Another terrible legacy of the US/Vietnam War is the legacy of Agent Orange. In 1990, I photographed Dr. Phuong with these Siamese twins. She was one of the first, as an obstetrician, to notice so many deformed babies and deformed fetuses and called attention to this. In 2010, I spent time with two families afflicted with Agent Orange. This is Nguyen Thi Le and her mother. Neither were directly exposed, and this is the great tragedy of Agent Orange, that it's passed down, these diseases are passed down genetically with no end in sight. Vo Thi Nam is another mother of two boys afflicted with diseases associated with Agent Orange. Typical diseases are spinal bifida, misshapen faces, bodies, and eyes, inability to walk. She spends all her time caring for her two boys. This is Tan Tri. I just saw them again in December. I love being with them, actually. I find that this family, despite their hardship and her terrible sadness, they're very peaceful. Here's Tan Tri. He pulling himself along on the floor. After these pictures were published, and they've been published many times, and they've helped to raise a lot of awareness, for the first time the U.S. government recognized that Agent Orange, they recognized these diseases that are passed down genetically, not just the environmental problems, because it's true that the water and the soil are still contaminated, but the U.S. government refused to see the humanitarian need. And I believe that my photographs contributed to Senator Patrick Leahy visiting Da Nang about a year ago and visiting the very families that I photographed. Tan Hao on the left and Tan Tri on the right. They have no access to physical therapy, so it's the parents who do that for them. What I find so moving is that these innocent children are so unaware. After I took this photograph, I was so overcome, I had to run out of this therapy center where it was the mother doing the physical therapy. And I ran out behind, and I couldn't stop crying. But there are wonderful stories of the legacy. Vietnam vets returning to build schools and clinics. This is a vet called John Abbey who came with his daughter Courtney to visit for the first time a school that he funded. Saigon today, at the time this was Saigon's tallest building. Every time you turn around, there's another tallest building. This is the Bitexco Tower at 68 floors. But you'll notice there's only one floor lit because they can't rent out the office space. And this is sort of a little peek into the terrible economy in Vietnam. Most of these office spaces are unleased. They're sit empty. And you notice the helicopter pad up there. Very bad design. They can't use it as a helicopter pad because any helicopter landing is just, the winds will just blow it right into the building. It's rather useless. Saigon today. You know, the whole time I've been in Saigon, all I've ever heard during the 90s was, we've got to manage, you know, we've got to manage the urban chaos and the traffic. We've got to plan. We need a subway. We need a metro. We need better public transportation. And it was just talk, 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 and nobody did anything about it. And this is the way the traffic looks today. Some people like to say, well, the Vietnamese have a system. They know how to sort of move through the streets like this. But in fact, there are terrible traffic accidents all the time. Designer stores have come to Vietnam, but they're franchises. They're owned by rich Vietnamese, usually wives of corrupt government officials, and often sit empty. But it's a status symbol to have a Gucci franchise. I mean, why have a Gucci purse when you can have a Gucci franchise? An ice skating rink. Unbelievable when I saw this. An ice skating rink in a new mall called Royal City Park, Royal Park City Mall outside of Hanoi. And to be gay in Vietnam is not looked down upon. In fact, the US ambassador is married to his husband, and they have a child. New Rich, this man owns Trung Nguyen Coffee, which is like the Starbucks of Vietnam. He brought 100 Arabian horses by airplane from Australia. Taste and luxury come to Vietnam. This is the Am Noi Resort. Yet at the same time, terrible poverty still exists. These are migrant workers who have come in from the countryside to build mansions. But when I asked them how they felt living here in this tiny little shack, they said, we're happy because we have a steady income and we have a roof over our heads. Censorship is severe in Vietnam. These are bloggers who are hiding out in a church, taking refuge, being surveyed by a guy across the street. This artist told me if these pictures were ever shown publicly, he would be thrown immediately into jail because they show a defaced Ho Chi Minh. Vendors on the street in Saigon, which to me represent the underclass, that class of people who are aware of what they'll never be able to afford. There's basically no upward mobility. Viet Q, the overseas Vietnamese returning to Vietnam, is a big story. Here at the Chill Bar in Saigon, I was hearing all around me Australian, French, Germans, and when I turned around, they were all Vietnamese looking. Viet Q coming back for humanitarian purposes. This is Diep Vung, who educates girls and young women about sex trafficking, and also counsels those who have been sex trafficked, how they can begin their lives again. These Viet Q, the woman in the red pants and the guy in the middle in the front, grew up in Pasadena and have come back to Vietnam to nurture a whole new form of Vietnamese rap. The artist Dinh Quy Le, who escaped, came back. He's a very successful modern artist, and this piece from a series called From Hanoi to Hollywood is an actual literal weaving of strips, two photographs, three photographs showing and the black and white is a Vietnamese villager, and the color a still from the quiet, from the film The Quiet American. Suburbs outside of Saigon that look like Orange County. This is Betty Tan on a Saturday morning with her tutor. Nobody in her family has actually been to the States, but there's this dream of American suburbia. Her father wants her to go to Andover and then to Harvard, but then to come back to Vietnam, where he's building two more houses in the same neighborhood, one for her and one for her brother, who was just born. He's thinking ahead, because in true Vietnamese style, families should stay together. Here's Betty Tan at her home, and here she is at a Saturday play date. Expensive dogs. These dogs cost the equivalent of $3,000 each. And that's it. Thank you so much. So we have a little time for questions and answers.
Yep, we have a good 15 minutes. Thank you, Catherine. It's really, really beautiful stuff. Very moving and colorful and a lot of things. We have microphones around the room, so if you'd please raise your hand if you want to give us your name and organization as well. I think Catherine's here to talk about her work in photography, not so much about the political situation in Vietnam. But please, who would like to get the discussion started? Anyone? As always, as a journalist, I'm always happy to kick it off. So I kind of want to ask you if you have a favorite series of photographs, because one thing I notice is that you're so part of the emotions that are going on in a picture, and how you actually get into the space. Do you have a favorite series of that?
You know, downstairs in the bar the past couple days, I mean, here I am, I've come to Vietnam. Where have I come? I've come to Hong Kong, and I love just sitting in that space down there, surrounded by all these of my favorite photographs of my entire career. These really are my favorite. I feel so close to them. I feel they're so close to me. I don't think I really have a favorite series. I'm proud of the photographs and my long relationship with General Zapp and his family. Those were not easy photographs to take. The photographs of the families afflicted with Agent Orange are deeply important to me, and I really would like to give a shout out to an organization called Children of Vietnam, which is an NGO that I work with closely. They're different from other NGOs because they know every family that they serve, and they know the needs, the specific needs of every family. So they don't just drop off random wheelchairs, which I've heard complaints from other families. I really would like everybody to be aware. There's literature out there which has the URL. So maybe that's my favorite series, because it means a lot to me, and because I do feel that those photographs are making change, which is desperately needed. And as an American, I feel a certain responsibility. We left, not we us personally, individually, of course, but as our country, our government, left behind well over 2.5 million people in Vietnam who have diseases associated with Agent Orange.
Right over here, please.
It's really impossible to look at all these photos and not bring up a question, the obvious question that everybody in the room must have if they've looked at what you've shown. When you see someone like Henry Kissinger on Fareed Zakaria never being asked a tough question, how does that make you feel?
I don't really know how to answer that question.
You must have thought about that.
Why Henry Kissinger can't answer a tough question, and why he's so evasive. Well, yeah, I know. Well, should we talk about the U.S. government here? Yeah. I have a lot of anger. I really do. I have a lot of anger towards the U.S. government. Gosh, I don't know where this is going to go. Turn off that video. that you know, they don't do enough. They just, for example, with Agent Orange is a perfect example, and landmines too, by the way. Amerasians, I have to say, finally, the Amerasian story has closure. There's only about 300 Amerasians left. But the U.S. still makes it difficult for even those 300 to leave Vietnam and come to the States. They're grilling them. They doubt them. You know, they say, oh, you know, you lied 3 times on previous applications. Whereas the French, after the defeat, after Dien Bien Phu, and the French brought all of their Eurasians back right away, no questions asked. But, I mean, change comes slowly with regard to the Agent Orange issue, for example. A lot of words, a lot of exhortations, and change coming very slowly. But I don't think the government's really going to try to do anything about it, because it's impossible to prove scientifically, which they use as an excuse. And so when I or anybody says, well, this isn't a victim of Agent Orange, it's only by circumstantial and evidential, you know, because their grandfather was directly exposed. The story speaks to this, but it can't be proved. So the U.S. likes to use that as an excuse.
We have a question right here.
Hi, Babette Rackett-Thomas. I'm a fashion journalist. Just it tags along with Tara's question at the beginning, but when you went, and obviously with General Zapp and his family as well, and with a woman on the train, you get quite engrossed with people. You're really in there and you build a relationship. How did you find the people that you were photographing, how did you find their response to you as a photographer, or maybe as an American, and also as a woman, and also the language as well? How was that? Thank you.
Sure. Well, I actually always have a translator, because it's very important to me that I always like to communicate, talk to people, hear their stories. So I always have a translator. You know, one reason why I love photographing in Vietnam is because the Vietnamese people, they're not only very friendly, they love journalists. I mean, when they see a photojournalist, a photographer, coming down the street with a camera, unlike other countries, leave unnamed, they give you a big smile and they say, oh, you are a photographer? Now, how could you not love that? Okay, it's not a struggle. For me, I've never found it to be a struggle to photograph in Vietnam. People are welcoming, they're curious. They don't seem to have a sort of taboo against being photographed. And I've made so many connections that last throughout these years. For example, this exhibit, well, not this exhibit, but many of these photographs in much larger form, huge, are going to, I'm going to have an opening in Hanoi. So if you find yourself in Vietnam, April 10th, the Art Vietnam Gallery in Hanoi. And what it's going to be so exciting is that many of the subjects in the photographs, people that I met and photographed 25 years ago, including the woman on the train, they're going to come to the opening. And this really sums up, you know, my feeling about the importance of photography and my history in Vietnam. What is photography for? What is it about? It's about creating long-lasting relationships. It's about making the subjects in my photographs just as pleased and happy and warm feeling as I feel. It's mutual. And it's going to be very exciting at this opening to see the woman on the train, Phuong An Nguyen, who was grabbing the chicken. You didn't see it here, but a barber I photographed on the street. The entire Zap family are all going to show up. So that's what Vietnam is for me.
That should be a heck of a night. Over here, please.
Very inspired by your talk. Vietnam myself. Travel there often. How would you describe the cultural values of the Vietnamese from your observations of 25 years?
Can you be a little more specific in your question?
Well, you know, when we talk about people, they tend to be a certain way if we stereotype a little bit. So the Brits tend to be stiff upper lip and get on with it. And how do you describe the Vietnamese, for example?
Well, you know, it's interesting because there's a palpable generation gap. Out of a population of about 92 million, about 60 million of those have always known war. And the younger generation have never known war at all. And so on the one hand, they're very different, the younger generation, and they resemble the younger generation everywhere. You know, we don't have to go into the details, but they're always on their iPhones, texting, this kind of thing. And I struggle to see if that younger generation still has the qualities that the older generation does: tenacity, perseverance, indefatigability. Am I pronouncing that right? I think it's there underneath the surface. So I hope so. Some people will say there's an identity crisis in Vietnam right now. They don't, you know, because you also have, traditionally, you have the Confucian ethic that the older generation has grown up with, which is obey the master, don't question, don't think outside the box. But there's a fear that Vietnam will not evolve into the future if this younger generation doesn't start being creative and disruptive and thinking outside the box. They say the Vietnamese are good at creating hardware, but not so good at creating software. So we'll have to see.
Time for just a couple of more questions. Right over here.
What drew you to photography? And is there a particular subject that you...
What drew you to photography to begin with? And is there a particular subject you like to photo? I mean, you know, people or, you know, seeing landscapes, that type of thing.
Well, I started shooting in high school in 10th grade, and within about 6 months that I knew I wanted to be a photographer the rest of my life. So it was set, chosen, decided. I just knew it. My father, as you know, was a journalist. My mother was an absolutely amazing artist. And so I got both of that from them. And I shot voraciously in high school to the point where my parents started to get a little worried. So I was always in the dark room until well after midnight. And then I went to college, and I purposefully did not study photography because I knew I was going to be married to it the rest of my life. So I studied all those other wonderful things that are fun to study, like modern art and religious studies and film theory and, oh gosh, French literature and all those kinds of things. And then after I graduated, I just plunged right back into the photography as I knew I always would. And I would say that what I like to photograph is exactly what you see here. It's on location, authentic, real life people. I'm a terrible landscape photographer. I love taking a walk, but that's about it for nature for me. I mean, I love shooting here in Hong Kong, energy, people, life, scenes, moments, and then getting inside of people's homes, getting inside of their emotions and feelings, trying to portray that and just trying to show truths as much as you can. No one photograph tells the whole truth. It just says a truth.
We'll take one more question here.
What do you think of the selfies?
I've never seen one actually up close, a selfie stick. I've just seen pictures of selfie sticks.
They're all over here now.
Yeah. Hey, you know, here's my feeling about the proliferation of photography today in every form, okay? I love photography. If everybody else loves photography, what could be wrong with that? I think it's a good thing. Plus, since I teach fabulous workshops, if you're interested, in my Umbria workshop, for example, there's cards out there on the table. It's, you know, I'm happy that everybody loves photography today. because I love to teach. As much as I love to shoot, I love to teach. And there's a world of people out there who want to learn.
Catherine, thank you so much for your time today. We're pleased that you're here in Hong Kong. Thank you for sharing your work.
Thank you.
A small gift from the FCC.
Wow. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And do come back and visit us again.
Thank you.